Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, once again, joined by a Division I head coach as we talk about recruiting. It is now September. The class of 2025 can talk to Division I coaches, but I am joined by Boston University head coach Ryan Pulley, and we are speaking before September 1st. We're talking on August 31st, the eve of that date of first contact. When you hear this, it'll be about a week removed. But that being said, this is a evergreen topic. Hopefully these podcasts are listened to years into the future by parents going through the process and trying to learn a little bit more about how coaches navigate it on their end. Coach Pulley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Terry. You know, real happy to be here and looking forward to our discussion.
No doubt. So, you know, I want to start, we kind of structured these conversations talking about evaluation and communication as two separate topics. You know, I think that you are a really, really good evaluator of talent, and I want to know why. How do you describe yourself as an evaluator?
I think one of the most important things that has allowed me to evaluate some high level is not only looking at potential, looking down the road of what a player could be, but not getting caught up in matrix. I'm not, and when I say that, I'm most specifically talking about size. I think some of the best players that I've been around have been under 6 foot, and whether that's a defensive player, Michael McCormick at Yale comes to mind, you know, very great lacrosse IQ, great stick works, great, did all the intangibles, hard worker. You know, it was obviously the best player that we've had at BU. You know, he left, but Chris Gray was, you know, undersized. And just not getting caught up in worrying about, okay, we need a 6'2", long, you know, athletic. You know, I view lacrosse as being super, a really cool sport and a special sport because you can be successful not being the tallest person. You can be have the best stick skills out there and find your niche somewhere, or have the best IQ or anticipation or ball skills or whatever it might be. And I've been able to kind of attract myself to some of those players that might have been overlooked because of athleticism or size, put them into a system, you know, really, you know, do things that complement their skill set and then have them be successful at the next level.
One of the things about that, because I'm at the opposite end of the spectrum, and I've talked about it a lot on these prior conversations, where, you know, I do value athleticism and I do have a size bias. Now, it's not exclusive from the standpoint of, you know, if you are special athletically but small, I'm going to notice that as well. But when you and I talk about prospects, your ability to really hone in on hands is something that stands out to me. Can you try to unpack and be a little bit more specific what it means to have good hands?
And you look at it on two sides of the ball. You look at it from an offensive standpoint where your hands are so critical, your hand-eye coordination to be able to catch the ball, you know, switch hands, shoot the ball, put the ball where you want to, develop skills. I mean, at the end of the day, if you have good hands, you typically can take your stick from whatever it is in high school and continue to increase at the college level, whether it's improving your range, improving your accuracy, you know, just improving it offhand if you have good hands. And the way we evaluate that is, you know, honestly, just watching a player and how smooth he is with his movements of hands, the way he switches hands, the way he, you know, we call it a hand exchange, how he goes from whether he's doing a split dodge or whether he's, you know, even, you know, doing a swim move, just how fluid he is. And typically your more fluid kids are the kids that have good hands, play other sports, receiver, football, point guard, basketball, quarterback, these positions that require good hand-eye coordination, ice hockey players. You know, we view that as potential for upside once a player gets in our program and we're consistently working on these skills in order to develop them. And then on the defensive side, I mean, this is kind of where I've made a lot of hay, just being able to recruit guys that just have great ball skills. I call them ball skills. It's guys that can do the intangible things that lead to getting stops on defense. You know, I've been lucky to have some great defenses both at Yale and you know, continued at BU, where we don't have the most imposing guys. We don't necessarily, you know, put in these schemes where we're just going to win our matchups, but we rely a lot on team defense and we rely a lot on ending possessions. And the way you end possessions are you cause turnovers, you get deflections, and most importantly, you pick the ball up and you're able to get to space and control the ball and be able to transition the ball up and get the ball to your offense. So those ball skills are something that I really value when it comes to recruiting defensemen. And, you know, I view it in a way that, you know, team defense is critical, and you're going to be better than the sum of your parts. And maybe someone who doesn't have the most athleticism, doesn't have the biggest size or strength, maybe not the great feet, but if he can do those intangible ball skills, it can really help your defense. And then support it and understanding your roles. I mean, it is okay if you have these tremendous ball skills, but you can't necessarily cover. We know we got to support you. We know we're going to have to slide to you. We know we're going to have to hedge to you. We're going to have to do these different things. Now, listen, if you can put it to Patrick Morrison on our team right now, he can guard, he can play in space, and he's got a great stick. Like that, we would love to have four Patrick Morrisons out there that are 6'2", 6'3", have great feet, can move. He's perfect, but sometimes you don't find all those. So you find someone who's, you know, nothing to get comparing Roy or Patrick. You find someone that's 5'11", 6', a little under recruited, that does all the intangible ball skills, can get the ball off the ground, has great anticipation, deflects passes, and you put that together and you have a pretty good team defense.
Yeah, it was really eye-opening in that respect, watching your practice last fall from the standpoint of, you know, how Roy Meyer, who was, if not my favorite player, certainly during the 22 season and then also a little bit in the 23 season, he was in my top three favorite players. Like, watching Roy Meyer was, like, one of the things that I enjoyed the most. It was like watching Dennis Rodman rebound the ball. And then you see him in one-on-ones, and you're like, okay, so that's why he's always in position to pick off passes, because BU's putting themselves defensively in a position where he's not having to guard isolations behind the goal. And I think that that's where one of the things that's really interesting is about how, you know, I think we've heard time and again that recruiting is not about building an all-star team, right? It's about fit. It's about a fit from the standpoint of how the chemistry of the players fits together personality-wise. It's a fit in terms of, you know, how the academic opportunity and social opportunities at the university fit what the prospects' interests are. But I also think one of the really compelling things about fit is projecting to a role. And so, you know, there are a couple of aspects of how you have constructed your program, and really on a committed basis. And I'm specifically referring to the 10-man ride and how, you know, you guys have been committed to that for a comparatively long period of time, as you've seen, you know, that style of play become more prevalent in the last couple of seasons. Generally, the question is about recruiting to role. But then, more specifically, the question is about recruiting to finding a role within that style of play, that 10-man ride style of play. Where's the balance between recruiting the best player versus recruiting the player who we can envision filling a role that we know our team is going to have?
You hit it on the head. It's not about the five, you know, depending on what your class is, bringing in the five best offensive players. It is, or the best three defensemen. It is about, okay, we're going to take one guy in the class who can cover. All right, so he might not have the best stick, but he's got great feet. He's got great athleticism. He's strong on the corners. All right, let's go get the best guy that we can at that position. All right, well, we need somebody in the middle of the field. We need a playmaker. We need a guy who is comfortable taking chances and making plays. And we know, you know, there's pros and cons of that. You know, the pro is you put pressure on the offense, you create a turnover. The con might be he might not get every over the head check, or he might not be able to take the ball away. And, you know, you get run by and you give up a 4-on-3 and you got to defend that. So, you know, it's really about fit. It's about, you know, certainly just the focus on, you know, you're talking all athletic, and you're talking all the, you know, don't half of it is who they are as the person. How hard are they going to work? How are they going to fit into your program? How much do they want to be at BU? Like, those are the types of things that, you know, you're just hitting these intangibles on a athletic standpoint, and talk about all the intangibles on a non-athletic side. And then that's how you get your full picture.
Opening up the conversation a little bit, it's not all you. Your staff plays a huge role in building out your roster. Who's on your staff, and what are those roles?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that, Terry, because there are times, you know, just for people out there who don't know, if you get on TV and even sometimes on some local broadcasts, you'll end up you know, working with the local broadcast crew, and they'll ask you questions, but they typically want to know about the team. And you know, I've regretted sometimes not talking, you know, weaving my staff into that because of just how important they are to the program and the great job they do. So you might go through a whole broadcast and the broadcaster doesn't even mention this, the assistant coaches, because they're so focused on the players. So I'm so glad they asked that question. You know, my second in charge is Mike Slippo, associate head coach. Mike's been with me for 7 years now. And, you know, I think our most recent success is certainly, you know, relevant with the amount of work that Mike has done. Mike is a A-plus recruiter. He is a great offensive mind. You know, he's a great, you know, a support system for me, and you know, he's one of the young stars. So Mike is, you know, fabulous, and just does a great, takes a lot of pressure off me in the recruiting. He's been our recruiting coordinator for 5 or 6 years now, and just does a great job of not only evaluating, see these players, but organizing our recruiting. We just hired Jack Roulette. You know, really excited to work with Jack. He obviously had a great playing career, both professionally and currently as a PLL All-Star, one of the top players in the world, and most recently.
Incredibly currently is last weekend he shouted out, while mic'd up on the field, any prospective 25s who want to come be Terriers, woof woof.
Yeah, it was pretty hysterical, and I'm sure his his Instagram or however people communicate with the young folks will be blowing up on September 1st. So, you know, excited to see just how, you know, certainly if I was a recruit and one of the best players in the world wanted to reach out to me, I at least want to have a conversation with them. So, you know, excited to see how Jack can be of assistance to our recruiting. But outside of just a great player, you know, really looking forward to getting Jack on our staff. I think he's got really youthful energy. He's really knowledgeable, and he's really diligent. He's diligent and experienced past his years. Worked under Kevin Warren, who's I have a ton of respect for, and you know, really excited to get you know, Jack going with our players, and certainly utilize him as a weapon in recruiting. And then third is Steve Moreland. Steve, knows Steve for a really long time. He's a local club coach here in the Boston area. Has had stints at Andover and Governors, and did a great job. And you know, is kind of transitioning his lacrosse career to get outside of high school, more into the club game. But has been a great fit for us. And with the change in rule where we can utilize a third assistant, has been fantastic this summer.
Last fall, I visited practice, as I mentioned, and it was really fortunate that I arrived as early as I did, because I got to sit in on the practice planning session. And then after that, you and I were hanging out, and I asked about essentially scholarship allotment. One of the reasons that I think this podcast series has been so well received is, I think there are two reasons. The first is because, you know, largely I've been having pretty casual conversations with guys that I've known for a really long time. And then in addition to that, I think, you know, we've mined topics that are very germane to the process, but don't frequently get talked about. You opened a spreadsheet, and let me read what I wrote verbatim. 21 cells on the x-axis, one for each of the three semesters over the next 7 years, and approximately 82 cells on the y-axis, one for each of the 53 players in the current roster and 29 players committed in each of the next two classes, though the cells with the players' names were hidden. Each cell had a percentage representing the portion of scholarship the player was set to receive that semester, and the sum of the row at the bottom showed how closely to fully allocated they were. And we don't need to get into the specifics in terms of like all of that, but I want to ask about how you regard scholarship allotment equivalent to the way that a professional GM manages a salary cap. How similar is it?
Identical. I mean, it is, outside of having to renegotiate, and but even sometimes,
I mean, yeah, you know, you're still sometimes.
Yeah, a player comes in on a low scholarship, and we've had some players come in on zero scholarship, and they're starting as a freshman, and you kind of look at yourself and you're like, this kid deserves to be on a scholarship. So, you know, there are part of renegotiation. I mean, the one thing is you can't cut anybody and, you know, get the, you have salary cap ramification. So, I mean, there's, it kind of only moves one way, which is the way it is. But, You know, it's just I'm thankful for people that don't know. I worked in the professional world for, you know, my first 6 years out of college, was a high school coach for 3 years, and then a part-time head coach at Merrimack. So I was in the finance world. You know, I like numbers, so it very comfortable for me, and very fortunate to have great assistant coaches. So I can be a CEO, CFO of a program from a budgetary and the scholarship standpoint, and be good with the spreadsheet and try to maximize the kids that we get and make it fair. I mean, at the end of the day, you're trying to, you know, we only get 12.6, so you try to find the kids that you feel fit in your program, and then you try to make the university affordable. And whether you use financial aid through the university, you know, some folks have a little bit more means, so do you try to, you know, figure it out with them in that respect? And then some players are just great players and, you know, deserve a large scholarship. So it's a huge puzzle. I would be lying to say if I don't enjoy it, but there are times that it's really stressful. We're a very expensive university. There's times that you really believe a family that it's hard to pay whatever they have to pay minus the discount of the scholarship. So it's, and again, it's not my money, it's the program's money, and we're trying to do it the right way. But, you know, it's been a successful thing for us, the plan, and we just try to be fair. At the end of the day, we're trying to be fair and make the university affordable for anybody that we think can play for us.
One of the things that we haven't discussed yet that's come up after the conversation was over a few times is basically that there are positions on the field that command scholarship allotments that are greater than other positions on the field that don't. What are they?
It's supply and demand, and it's just the market value. It's just like anything else. You get a certain position or a certain house in a certain, you know, on the beach, they're going to cost more. And, you know, for whatever reason, certainly, you know, sorry, defensemen out there, but the offensive players have typically, you know, garnered more attention when it comes to scholarship money. So certainly your attackman, you know, if you can be a ball carrying attackman that can do multiple things, you know, you're typically at the top of your class. You know, you put yourself in a good position to just receive a little bit more money. You know, certainly depending on how much you value a face-off, there's some programs that value face-off, they get their guy, they're going to give, you know, a very large chunk of change to those players. And, you know, that's great for them. You know, for us, we're trying to, you know, we're trying to balance this thing. You know, we're trying to build a roster. We're trying to make sure that we do our best to be, you know, adequate and talented in multiple, in all positions. And it's a little bit of, you know, roster analysis, where are you weak and where do you need to improve? And you allocate funds for that particular class to that position to make sure you get somebody in that class. You know, certainly I'm sure we'll get into it as we get into our recruiting conversation, but the face-off and goalies are all, it's really hard. It's really hard because only one plays. It's really hard to recruit the position because you never know. You know, you got 10 on your board, and you know, you look at, you want to get one, but if you wait for one, you might lose out on 2 through 7, trying to wait for one to make his decision. If one says no, now you're down to 8, and you know, so it's really interesting. And I'm sure it's challenging for the face-off parents and prospects, because it's a little bit of a courtship between trying to figure out what school likes you and what school is a good fit for you, and also just dealing with most schools only taking one. So to answer your question, you know, certainly the offensive positions, sometimes the specialty positions, and then certainly those you know, middies that can score. But honestly, Tyler, we started to put more of an emphasis on defensive middies from a recruiting standpoint. We, until maybe 3 or 4 years ago, we were under the philosophy of we'll take maybe 2 or 3 middies at the, you know, in the class that are, you know, good lacrosse players, but have a little bit extra athleticism. And if it doesn't work out, we will convert them to D-middy. And at times it worked, but more so than not, it didn't work. And we said, okay, we need to fix this. And we need to – it didn't work for a couple of reasons. Number one, they didn't have a ton of experience playing defense. And number two, a lot of times they didn't want to play defense. So there was always this resistance of, you know, I scored a lot in high school and I still can score. And, you know, you're looking at a kid saying, you are good. but you're on our third line. And you maybe at some point you will break into our second line, but right now you're not, and we could use you. So there's always this, kind of feeling out process, and you want to do what's best for the kid, and you want the kid to buy into his role and be really proud of his role. And most likely this kid's played offense for 7 or 8 years. So we've changed our philosophy a little bit, and we have recruited D-middies, and we have conversations now. And we just recruit D-middy. You're going to be a D-middy. And if a kid doesn't want to be a D-middy, then that's okay. You know, then go try to play offense at another school. But and there's guys that think they're offensive middies, and you know, but we are calling them, and they'll hear from us tomorrow, and we'll say, listen, I know you scored 30 goals last year, and you play offense for your club team, but we are recruiting you as a D-middy. And if you don't like that, that's okay. But this is what we're going to recruit you as, because we see value in that. And if you think about it from a midfield perspective, and I think kids should hear this, D-middies are on the field way more than offensive players. They're on the wing of faceoffs. They're in the riding game. They're in the clearing game. Certainly, if you do have that offensive skill, you can, put in packages to be on the offense end early on the shot clock. So, we try to encourage kids to keep an open mind and think about it. And some kids embrace it and love it and like, oh, coach, that's really cool. I just want to play. And they mean that. And other kids goes, hey, coach, I'll talk to you later. I'm going to go talk to these guys that think I can actually play offense. So all good.
I started this podcast by saying that I think you're a really good evaluator. And one of the reasons that I think that is because you have had not only tremendous teams at Boston University and tremendous individual players come through, but also you've had a number of great players who have committed to be Terriers and then have decommitted, committed elsewhere, and gone on to tremendous careers as well. So it's not like folks should realize that like Ryan Pulley's like track record of identifying talent is not only limited to the players that have come through the program or that came through Yale as well. But probably the most high profile example was Griffin Schutz, the Virginia midfielder who was committed to you before the rule change in 2017. And I know that you had a relationship with him, prior to that in terms of being around him a little bit as a coach, or at least that's what I understand it to be. And now he was our number one recruit in the class of 2021 and has certainly gone on to contribute as a Virginia Cavalier. What has it been like? How has the evolution been? And I should also mention, like, it's not the only one. It's not, I think, probably highest profile example. Anthony DeMayo probably, in that category as well. But what's it been like as a progression for the program in terms of, you're the first coach in the program's history, and it's coming up on a decade now. And so when you're starting a program, you're getting players who are taking a chance on what it could become, as opposed to joining something that they know exists. And I'm assuming and pretty confident that faith played a role in some of that. It was your ability to identify them early that got them on board. But it was the uncertainty as to what the program was going to be able to offer and provide that ultimately, made it difficult to keep them committed for a long time. What's that process been like, as the program has evolved and as the rules changed?
It's bittersweet, Terry. I mean, it is, you look at the guys, another Quentin Buckman was your top middie, maybe number two recruit in the class or whatever.
In 2018,
We've been able to identify it, identify players. I mean, early, I think that it does speak to our ability, and it's just not me, it's my staff, but our staff to identify kids early in their careers with potential. And it was different before the rule change, and the rule change that Terry's referring to is you used to be able to talk, if they initiated the conversation, you could talk to prospects before September 1 of their junior years, and you could actually have them on campus, so you could extend an offer. And we were committing freshmen and sophomores, and everybody, understands the evolution of that. But, the ability to understand that, commit kids early that were going to be stars future, but that it also gave you a longer runway to keep these kids. And these kids would develop into great players later in their careers in junior year and, senior year. And then certainly, we are still at the mid-major level. I mean, I'm not embarrassed to say that. We are mid-major, and we are trying to transition Boston University, and we're still, 5 years. I don't know what the years are, but we're still a ways from being a major school. And we're not a BCS school with football, so we don't have the revenue opportunity. So all we have to do to make ourselves a blue blood in lacrosse is we have to work hard and continue to win. So I think some of the reason we lost some of those high-profile players was because we did not have the track record and the success at these other schools. We were building it, and certainly we identified it, and we have great things to offer here at BU, but those players all wanted to go on to universities that had a little bit more track record in winning and Final Fours and competing for a championship, and that was what was best for them and their families. I think we learned a little bit more, too, about just you commit to BU and then you don't hear from us, but we had to be ever present in continuing to recruit these kids. Griffin's case was an odd one because he was committed to us and then the rule changed and we couldn't talk to him. So we went through almost a year and a half with no contact with Griffin, and then all of a sudden it kind of September 1 hit and everybody could call him, so us included. So it was a little bit, and certainly it is what it is, but I'm proud of the fact that we've been able to identify some great players and get them committed to BU. We do have great things to offer here. I'm proud of our track record over the last couple of years. Now, since the recruiting has backdated a little bit, you're dealing with more mature players. So I think certainly as we go through the process, we talk about it. Well, if you develop the way that we think you're going to develop, you're going to get calls, and we kind of talk about, I want you to choose BU because you love BU, not because this is your only opportunity or not because of whatever. I want you to choose it because you believe in what we're doing. And again, if someone calls you and it is the best thing for your family, it is what it is. But you help, you build these relationships with kids. They want to be at BU because they're believing exactly what they do. And, for these up and coming classes, these are going to be the classes that get us from mid-major to major. And that's the way that I look at it. And certainly our current, senior class and our fifth-year returners, they've accomplished that. We used to talk about, hey, we haven't won a Patriot League championship. You're coming here to win a Patriot League championship. You're coming here to compete for Elite Eight and Final Four opportunities, and they've done that. And now they got one more shot at it, and they're really hoping to achieve what they came here to do. And the classes behind that is get us to the next level. And we want kids that want to do that, and that's the most important thing to them.
Did you see and experience that in your class of 24 conversations on the heels of winning the Patriot League championship and making it to the NCAA tournament in 2022?
Yeah, 100%. It was an evolution of, you build great club relationships and great high school relationships. And as you, call these kids on September 1, email these kids, text these kids on typically the, and I'm talking pre-winning the Patriot League, regular season 2 years in a row, Patriot League championship 2 years ago, we typically could get the kid to answer our phone. There was a respect factor between the club coaches that they said, listen, at least listen to these guys. They do a good job. They run a legit program. They do things the right. Please listen to their conversation. But we couldn't get the kids to campus. So as we started to get more successful, we started to get the kids to campus, but we couldn't close deals. You win a Patriot League championship, you win two back-to-back. We haven't seen the results of the back-to-back one, but winning that Patriot League championship, we got kids to camp. We got people to answer our phone calls. We got them to campus, and then we were able to commit kids. So it's an evolution. Our 24 class is the most talented class by far we've ever had.
Shifting the focus of the 25s a little bit, and realizing you can't talk about particular players. Just broadly, how are you approaching this group?
I would say continue. It's a very talented group. I mean, the amount of players, the way that lacrosse is being played, the start at an early age, the specialization, the amount of club participation, say what you want about it, it is developing very talented players. So I think it's a very deep and talented class. For BU specifically, we we are graduating so much at the end of this year, we have loaded up on our 24 class, you know, this is going to be a small class for us. So we are going to be very, I'm going to say small class, probably in the range of, you know, 10 to 12 players. You know, we're going to be very specific about what we're looking for and very picky, you know, as we move forward. So I think there's, you know, our list, and I'm talking all positions, is typically, and I'm talking guys that are guys that are on our list are going to hear from us September 1, and, you know, we're going to try to get to campus. It was typically between 60 and 75 players. I think this year is probably going to be between 45 and 60. So it's probably, you know, 15% smaller, a little bit. And listen, we might have to go outside of that. We certainly have the next up list. But with the small class and some specific needs, you know, we're going to target a little bit smaller group.
How can – well, two-part question. First part is, fast forward 9 months from now, how many of those 40 to 50 kids do you think you have commitments from? And second part is, reverse that over the last 10 years. How consistent is – I think this is our list, and I think these are the two or three kids we're going to get. How consistently accurate is that expectation?
We did this exercise, Terry, so this is a very relevant question. We did it 2 years ago, our 23 class and 24s. You know, it's all color-coded. It's a nice grid with our recruiting service, the way they do it. There were very few. We put them in red because we're Terriers. Very few red kids in the 23 class. We had to go way down our list. And again, it's some of our best kids we've ever committed weren't even on our list. So it's not an indictment on our current 23 class. It was just who we identified as being the best players at September 1 of that recruiting cycle and who we got. Then you fast forward to 24, and we got – our page was all red. We were able to identify the guys we wanted. So building off of that Patriot League championship, I don't know what 25 is going to be. You don't know till you make the phone call. You don't know till you go through your process. And guys come and go. They come up for a visit. You don't like them. It's not a right fit. You know, they break up with you before you even get them on the phone. So, you know, there's certain, you know, you do your best to kind of understand the landscape and, you know, try to figure it out, but you just never know. And we want to recruit the most talented kids with the best, highest character. And, you know, not force them to say no, but you never know. You never know when a kid has family in Boston. You never know. You never want to take someone else's, you know, word or, you know, position of like, you don't have a shot, or just assume because this player, you know, is going to have, you know, some great opportunities at some great schools that you don't have a shot at BU just because we're in a great city. We have a great education. We play in a fantastic league. We are an up-and-coming program that competes with all the big dogs. So, you know, it's mine and my – I'm so competitive and my staff is so competitive. Is like, why can't we get that kid? You know what I mean? So, and sometimes it can be not as efficient. But for that one kid that could maybe change your program or be a four-year starter, multiple Patriot, like it's worth at least, you know, the energy to see what's going on.
What was Chris Gray's recruiting story?
Chris, Coach Keller, UMass Lowell coach, had a relationship with Coach Winkoff, we didn't have a team when Chris committed. We were in our process. Is that true? Maybe that's not true. Maybe it was at the very, very first year, but it was super early. And Kelleher saw Chris at an event and was like, we have to have this kid. He came on campus. He was being recruited by some other – he was small. I mean, Chris is now is 5'9", and I think at the time he was 5'7". I saw Chris play one time, and it was during football season, and he came up to a Harvard event and he got banged up the day before, so he wasn't playing that much, and Chris literally caught the ball at X and like smoked his guy like I've, you know, like Chris does, and scored a goal. And literally, I think Chris played 2 minutes that day. And I think I saw Chris do one dodge. And, you know, obviously you trust your assistant coaches. And I'm like, you could just tell. I mean, it's so funny. Recruiting's so funny in that way. And I think some of the reason, Terry, you mentioned, just you just trust your gut. And I know people are like, oh, my God, you saw Chris Gray play one time. And, you know, you were – yes, I was. And, you know, obviously Drew had seen him a little bit more. But, you know, Chris came up. We had a great visit. And Chris committed as a freshman. And then Chris just blew up. And it was when we could talk to Chris. So, you could talk to him as long as Chris initiated the conversation. And then it was defense. I went to four straight weekends of – football games. I went to almost one year we got knocked out early in the Patriot League, so everybody else was playing playoff lacrosse and I was at every one of Chris's game. I mean, I literally was on Long Island four straight weekends in the fall and four straight because I wanted to keep Chris. And it was touch and go, and had lengthy conversations with Dad about the other opportunities that they were in, and Chris stayed committed. And attribute Chris and his family for doing that, and he wanted to, you know, see what it was like at BU. And Chris had a great career at BU, and I've said this in other interviews, and you know, I don't want this to be, I want to be about BU and our future, but the sad thing about Chris accomplished everything that we told Chris he was going to accomplish. He was, you know, the face of our program as almost even as a freshman, certainly as a sophomore, you know, first team all conference, would have been the MVP of the league if it wasn't for Pat Spencer, and you know, trajecting to be a great player and take our program. And he decided to leave, and you know, that's his, you know, his family's decision. And Will, you know, still think very highly of Chris and his family. They're great people. And but it was obviously, you know, a tough pill to swallow, and we rebounded. You know, we just said, you know what, this is the strength of our program. This is an unbelievable opportunity for our program to show its depth. You know, you had guys, you know, I'll never forget this, you know, had to send out an email to the team that Chris was leaving, you know, and Louis Profeto, you know, I said, listen, we got, and I'm paraphrasing, but it was like, you know, the rest of the world is going to see this as like the demise of BU, and BU can't be good, and, you know, their best player in this, you know, certainly generational player is leaving, and we're going, in order for us to be good, we must band together. It's got to be the sum of our parts, and we have to play with a huge chip on our shoulder. And I got an email back from Louis Profeto, who is essentially, you know, taking Chris's place and has been a multiple year all paper. He said, I have two chips on my shoulder, because everyone thought that, you know, Louis couldn't do it. And Louis is different than Chris, but he certainly gets people involved. He's been a great player for us and has helped taken us to a Patriot League championship. So, this is more about BU and his future, but it's part of our history.
No doubt. It's really compelling in a lot of ways, because I think it does tie together a lot of what we otherwise talked about in terms of the evaluation, the commitment, the communication, the playing defense that you had to do, the evolution of the program. And I think it all does do a nice job of like kind of leading up and culminating into, you know, essentially where you currently sit. And we've talked a fair amount about how, you know, the evolution of handling success does change the challenge of, you know, the term I used previously was foraging versus sifting, kind of the hunter gatherers, like you forage for mushrooms and you sift for gold. The notion of over the course of the next couple of weeks, you're going to have to determine, does this kid want to come to BU for the same reasons that the kids that wanted to come to BU that gave us the success that we had and have? And he's going to help us, you know, duplicate and build upon that success and take it to new heights, you know, or does he want to be the beneficiary of the success that we have had? And he wants the cool things that have come with winning a Patriot League championship and everything that goes along with that. How do you regard that challenge?
It's exactly what we've been talking about. It's getting players that can continue our standard, continue our success, and then take it one step further. And certainly, the cell hasn't changed. The cell has just been a little bit of a moving target. The cell has come to BU, start the program, come to BU, get us to competitiveness, come to BU to compete for a Patriot League championship, come to BU to win a Patriot League championship, now come to BU to make some noise in the NCAA tournament, and hopefully it'll be come to BU to win a national championship. I mean, the cell, it's just a moving target as the success has accumulated. And, you know, I'm so proud of the guys. You know, we're talking about recruiting future, but let's not forget we kept our best players on this current roster. B is a wonderful place where other schools are losing their graduate students to Power Five schools right and left and transfer portal this and that. And BU kept all those guys. You know, outside of one player, every person that was offered an opportunity came back, decided to come back. And that's huge for us. And that's huge for the program. It serves validation to me that we're doing things the right way. We're recruiting kids that want to be at BU and make a difference at BU. And they don't want to go out for a one-year, you know, rental, essentially, and try to win at another place. They want to win at BU. So that's been great validation. Building on the success, but also, you know, we got to learn from our lessons from last year in order to, you know, handle success and reach our full potential. And then, you know, obviously with September 1 and the whole idea of this call is talking recruiting, continue to backfill that and continue to put in the pieces that can get our program to the next level.
Last question is about name, image, likeness. You've made mention of being a major program, a high major program, making the transition from being a mid-major to a high major. And, you know, there's some folks who would scoff at that notion because they define it exclusively on the basis of conference affiliation. But I also think that there is another way that you can define it, which is the ability to win a national championship. And I've long held that, essentially, if you can win a national championship in other sports, specifically men's ice hockey, you can win a national championship in lacrosse. And I don't know if there's a program that's won more. Now, I don't know enough about college hockey that this isn't going to get something that's going to get like people. I know that BU has won a fair amount.
Yeah, we've won five. I don't know if somebody's won more, but I know we've won five.
So, point being that, you know, if that is aspirational and realistically aspirational, then it puts you into a category from an NIL standpoint that you might not otherwise belong. And I know you've been thinking about it, and I know you mentioned previously your business background and the role that that plays in how you regard managing your scholarship allotments like a salary cap. How do you regard the role that NIL plays in the future of college sports and your program in particular?
As it plays relevance in college sports, it is what it is. The NCAA and the governing bodies made a decision that this is going to happen. It is available to players, and I view it as my job and my responsibility to explore through every option to make sure my players can participate in it. So within NCAA rules, you know, this summer, I don't think there's been a bigger project that I've worked on with the help of, you know, some lawyers and alums and people to figure out how to do this in a way that, number one, is NCAA compliant, number two, you know, legal, and number three, has a benefit for our players. So we're going to be giving, our goal is to give every one of our players an NIL deal. I mean, that is our goal for this season, and future players coming in, you know, they will have an NLI deal. You struggle with the reality of how teams do it, and I have no idea, but you hear rumblings and guys go to school X and they get a $20,000 NIL deal, and that's part of their BU's not going to do that. We are not going to buy player like that's part of our scholarship allotment is not going to be your NIL deal. But what BU will try to engage in, and I think we're very close to doing it, is you will have some certain responsibilities. You will have to do certain appearances. We do a great thing with Bike to the Beach charity event. You know, we do great things with Harlem Lacrosse. Guys come to campus, guys drink. You know, these are all things that can we take advantage of, and where guys were doing it out of the goodness of their heart for community relations and because it's the right thing. Okay, now can we, you know, can this be part of how you know, you get an NIL deal. You show up, you do your Bike to the Beach fundraising, you do your Bike to the Beach ride, and now you get compensated for it. So, you know, we're still kind of figuring out exactly legally to do it. But I also think, too, we're a team. You know, we are, and you got to remember, the best teams have buy-in through. Right now, we're at, you know, 58 players. I think, you know, we're looking to get that down. It's just COVID. We have these fifth years, but the best teams have buy-in one through whatever. You know, for us, it's one through 58. And if I, you know, can show player 58 that I'm looking out for him, and I'm going to incorporate him in what I do for player one. No, player one might get more money because he's, you know, he's experienced. He's been around. Whatever. But I'm thinking about player 58. And if everybody knows I'm thinking about, you know, there can be more buy-in to our program. So we're trying to come up with a NLI deal that has somewhat of equity, but also certainly our players that are high profile, that have done a great job, do great jobs on Saturdays, try to figure out to be competitive in the market. I don't know if I answered your question.
No, you did. I mean, I think that you answered it in a way that is so reflective of how every member of every staff has to answer it, right? And I think that, you know, your allusion to the way in which there are rumors in the market of how other staffs are approaching it, how other universities, how other donor alumni groups are approaching it, it's important to hear. I mean, you know, I don't know what's true and what's not. I know the rumors that exist, and, you know, I think we'll see how impactful it ends up being relative to how impactful it is in football and basketball, and also relative to how impactful it is, or how impactful people imagine it being. So it's a really interesting topic. I think you can make the argument that it's impossible to talk about recruiting without talking about name, image, likeness. I don't think that's fully true, but at the same time, if it doesn't come up at all in a, you know, 14-part series or whatever this is, then you're probably doing a disservice to the reality of the situation. So we appreciate your thoughts and candor.
Yeah, and I think it's important. I can't worry about what other schools are doing. I can worry about what the rules are, what I can do at BU, what I think is fair for my current team, future recruits, and try to, like I said, build an equitable system where guys can, you know, reap the benefits of their name, image, and likeness. That's all I can't. You know, you waste hours thinking about, oh my God, this school's doing X and this school's doing Y, and we can't compete. And what, you know what? Let's just vote. We got a great place. Kids want to come here. You know, we're doing something special, and let's focus on what we can do for those kids to maximize their experience.
It's a good note to end on. Ryan Poley, really appreciate your time on the podcast. Good luck as you continue to navigate the class of 2025. Get into fall ball. Maybe we'll figure out another opportunity to swing north and check out the folks on ComAv. And aside from that, we look forward to seeing you in action in the spring.
Great. Thanks, Terry. Appreciate your time.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.